There is a halfway mark between the known and unknown. A middle ground or chamber where divine wisdom and truth reside. In this middle chamber, we will explore and expose the ruling paradigms of social engineering, mind control, government conspiracies, and cover-ups. Join us as we navigate the territories and boundaries of natural law and the ancient principles of the sacred feminine and divine masculine. Examine and consider alternative energy systems, holistic healing arts, and wild soulful living to train our awareness in a most novel and abstract manner to view reality from an entirely new perspective. Welcome to the Middle Chamber.
Greetings once again, ladies and gentlemen. It is I, your hyperdimensional host for the duration, Freighter X. Welcome to another episode of The Middle Chamber. We are accompanied on this journey, as always, by my wife and co-conspirator, the lovely and amazing Mater X. Say hello to the listeners, my love.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Freighter X, for that wonderful introduction. It's good to be here, out of the self-imposed exile in the shadows of shyness. And so it might take me a moment to get my sea legs, so if you'll all just bear with me. I'm sure it'll be a great experience for us all.
That's right. She's stepping out into the spotlight, everybody, and she's going to take the helm, you know, right by my side, and we're going to start to address all these interesting topics and issues and subjects of discussion that, you know, are really near and dear to our hearts and things that we think that others would be really interested in hearing about and sharing with us. Tonight we have an awesome show for you. We are launching our reformatted and retrofitted podcast version of The Middle Chamber, which we will pre-record each week and then upload to the SyncBook Radio Network, which can be found at thesyncbook.com for your listening pleasure. And, you know, while we're on the subject, if you would like to go and check out all the other interesting shows over at the SyncBook, it's an amazing network. TheSyncBook.com, the SyncBook Radio Network has several other great shows, and hopefully they'll be growing as time goes by, and we want to thank them for giving us a new home on their team over there. So go over to TheSyncBook.com and check it out. And thanks to Alan and Doug and all the rest at Team Sync for all their help and assistance. And again, we're really excited about being here and having an opportunity to just basically, it's a way for us to share what's on our hearts and mind with the world. And, you know, we've got a captive audience in you, dear listener. So thank you for being here and letting us rant and rave and share what we have to say. So I also want to say tonight an extra special thanks to Rizzo and the Maniac Agenda for that brilliant intro we just heard. Thanks, guys. You really knocked it out of the park for us. We really appreciate it, and we're so excited to be back with a new sound and a new format and to be here with all of you listening all over the world out there. It's been a long, hard road to get back here, but we made it. And we have some really exciting guests and topics planned for the future on this all-new reformatted podcast. And as well, we have an upcoming public appearance by both of us, Freighter X and Mater X. Will first of the month, next month, Friday, April 4th, we will be at Brave New Bookstore in Austin, Texas, for the release of my new DVD, The Secret War on Human Consciousness, which is a DVD recording of the event last year at Philadelphia, Free Your Mind Conference 2. And it's in fact available online. You can just go to the website to find out how to get your copy today. And in just a moment, we will welcome our extra special guest for this episode's chat. Now, speaking of chats, this show's chat room, the new chat room, can be found at middlechamberchat.chatango.com or go to our website for the link, which is middlechamber, the letters fx.wordpress.com. That's middlechamberfx.wordpress.com. And we are on Facebook, unfortunately, and I'll get into my feelings about that as time goes by. Anyone who doesn't already know that I call him Fache Book. Actually, Vinny Eastwood, I think, was the one that coined that phrase, so I'll give him props for that. But anyways, unfortunately, you can find us on Facebook at FreighterX MaterX. So it's like first name, last name. FreighterX first name, MaterX last name. So FreighterX MaterX on Facebook. And
don't forget to mention the Middle Chamber page we have on Facebook.
Ah, yes. Thank you very much. The lovely MaterX right there to help me continue to remind everyone of all the places you can find information about the show. So we do have now a community page, the Middle Chamber, which is also on Facebook. So the subject of our discussion tonight will cover a broad scope and range, which you should come to get used to listening to us here in the Middle Chamber, because we tend to be expansive in our view. And so we will be focusing first on the ancient civilizations which inhabited the Philly Waterway region, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania waterway regions, as well as the ancient mound builder legends that surround that region and up into upstate New York and the Hudson River Valley area, which is also known as the Burned Over District. And there's a lot of history out there that is really fascinating. And I thought it would be a good time to start, because I'm actually preparing an article for Paranoia Magazine, and it will be the subject of my presentation at the Paranoia Conference 2014, August 2nd and 3rd in San Diego, California, which will be talking about fallen angels, giants, monsters, and dark occult and mystics in America. That's the going title so far. So anyways, we also want to talk about the colonial, mostly German Rosicrucian settlers who came into this waterway region and why they may have chosen to do so. That's important because, and that's where our guest tonight, Ross Ben from rossben.com, that's rasben.com, he's really got a lot of information gathered that's really important to bring to light. You know, the fact of the matter is that that's what our approach is all about. I mean, it's these kinds of crypto history, crypto archaeology and anthropology, as in hidden, you know, beneath the mainstream views. It's more important than one might imagine. You know, we are constantly trivializing and downplaying and creating novelties around these issues and ideas and, you know, legends and folklore, a lot of them. And this is our approach. We're looking at what might seem quite novel and considering greater meanings and implications. This is consistent with the show's mission statement. Why does it matter? Well, people may not realize the legends and myths that have been a part of the American landscape since long before the European conquest. And I do mean long before the European conquest. Many don't even know the fantastic prehistories, for example, of Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, when he recorded in his Book of Mormon, let alone the true histories, the true source of those histories, where the myths and legends of the people of the Hudson River Valley, you know, that's where a lot of the settlers created the most amazing ideas that were carried forth into the spiritualism movement and the, you know, what you could call the non-denominational Christian movements that rose up, like the Watchtower Society, the Christian Scientists, the Mormons, and a lot of other ones that people may not be aware of. There was one called the Universal Friend. There was the Millerites. There's the Shakers and Quakers and all kinds of different varieties of Christianized approaches to mysticism. And, you know, there was a lot of myths and a lot of legends around this burned over district that we're talking about. And so I thought it would be important for us to just kind of take a look at the, focusing first on the Philly Waterways area, because our guest tonight, Ross Ben, has taken a lot of time, and it's been his passion and burden on his heart to gather the information of the tribal peoples from that area. And he's also got a mission that he's sort of, kind of declared at the last Free Your Mind conference, which was free your mounds and the mind will follow. And it was really exciting to be with him at the event, and we hope to see him at the next event, which is going to be hopefully in 2015. And I'm hearing tell that the event will be moved. The venue is going to be at the Bucks County, Sheridan, in Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. So it'll all be in one venue, a huger location with a lot more amenities. So it's going to be an exciting time. So at this time, okay, we have the honor and privilege of welcoming back visionary researcher, writer, healer, family man, and friend to humanity, Ross Ben from rossben.com, as well as current resident of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Greetings, Ross, and many thanks for joining us here in the middle chamber.
Yes, sir. Greetings, Frater X and Mater X. Thank you all for having me.
Well, thank you for being here.
Yes, sir.
We've really been looking forward to this show. I know that when I ended up taking a little time off from the middle chamber, which I had on the last network, I needed to step back to kind of refocus my energies and get creative about finishing the book project that I'm still working on. We're in the editorial stage of The Secret War Inside Freemasonry. But, you know, I had you scheduled as a guest, and I had to unfortunately break our date to talk. And I'm really glad that we could pick right up. It really, to me, it's really a sense of continuity to pick right up where I left off by having you come on and help us to relaunch this reformatted version of the show.
Yes, I. I'm glad to continue building with y'all, you know, to free your mind. Conference was an amazing experience. Definitely, I call it the blow your mind because, man, all that we heard those 3 days, my mind was blown. It really was. And yeah, I'm just thankful for the opportunity to continue building with the Free Your Mind community.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to going back and being involved. I mean, it seems like it really has gained momentum since the first event and then carrying over to what we hope to see happen, you know, in 2015. And now we've got a real focus of, promoting it and trying to expand because we have a bigger venue, which means we can bring more people in. And, you know, I know personally that your contribution to the opening ceremony of the whole event was really remarkable to me, the helping to galactivation, frequency adjustment, resonating. It was a really powerful experience. So I'm looking forward to sharing in a newer and more, even more powerful experience in the future.
Yes, I.
So, you know, just to jump right in on what we're talking about, you know, we're really excited to continue to discuss your research into the mound builders of the Philadelphia region. Remembering, of course, as I already mentioned here, your talk at the Free Your Mind conference about free your mound to free your mind, which, you know, I understand it should be available soon for people to start viewing, correct?
Yes, yes.
I know you. Go ahead.
That is my goal, to get this up on YouTube very shortly.
Yeah, I know it's been a little bit of a struggle of patience waiting for the production of these videos for everybody's stuff to come out. I know that they're starting now to post them all on FreeYourMindConference.com, I believe, is the place where people can go to see it. And, of course, YouTube. If you type in keyword search, Free Your Mind Conference, then you'll find it there as well.
Yes. Yeah, I actually spoke with Brother Mike Anthony Falsetto today, and he said mine and Brother Curtis Illuminated One, our videos are next on the cutting block, you know, next on the editor's table. So that's good to know. I think I'm going to be able to get some of the raw footage too, and hopefully I'll get some up on YouTube on my channel, which is Rossben188. And yeah, I love sharing this topic. I don't get to focus on it as much as I would like. It's connected with a project that sounds like where your book is. I became entrusted with a project that is called Mystic Philadelphia, which is going to be a book. I think it's going to be birthed in 2014, you know, but time will tell. You know, birthing a book is not easy and does take time. So Creator will in 2014, but, you know, we will have to see. But the focus of Mystic Philadelphia is just looking at this amazing place located in what is today called the Delaware Valley, which in, you know, pre-colonial time was the Lenapehana Valley. And this was the land of the Lenape Hoki, who were Algonquin speakers, which encompassed many indigenous of the Americas, you know. And the Lenape, when you look at the Lenape and the Algonquin, there is a lot of, what you say, mystery to their history and traditions, because they are connected with what we would call the Olmec Moorish Empire, which seems to have flourished around 1500 years ago, centered in the Gulf of Mexico. And these pre-Columbian indigenous Americans were mound builders, and they tended to build their cultures around river valleys. So they took the Mississippi Valley north from the Gulf of Mexico. You see their culture spread northward, the largest settlement of which being the Cahokia Mounds, located not far out of contemporary St. Louis, Missouri. And it's guesstimated at one time the Cahokia Mound City complex, over 26,000 people dwelled in that one region. From the Mississippi Valley, these mound builders seem to have migrated into the Ohio River Valley, and then further east into what, like I mentioned, what is today called the Delaware Valley, which, you know, in that day was the Lenapehana. But why I say there's a kind of a mystery involved is because there's a lot of archaeological evidence that says the Lenape dwelled in this region for over 12,000 years. So maybe the appearance of the Black Turtle Clan mound builders was more of a resettlement and a reconnection of a mound building people more so than a settlement.
Right.
And why I want to bring that up is because when you talk about 12,000 years, you're now talking antediluvian. You're right. Talking prior to the Great Flood, you know? So this mound building culture, I think, is pre-flood, antediluvian, what would many would call Atlantean culture and civilization.
Well, Ross, let me ask you, what do you think the significance of the mounds and mound building is? I mean, have you uncovered any, like, answers, I'd say, to the mysteries about them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the mounds are a spiritual technology, okay? A technology that allows one to really tap into spirit energy, okay? So when we talk about spirit energy, we're talking about life force, you know, life force energy, and being able to tap into it. So generally speaking, we got three realms of spirit, right? We got an ancestral realm where those who have lived their spirit lives on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we got a terrestrial realm where, like, nature, earth, the earth force, the earth power, you know, manifesting in the environment around us. And then you got the celestial realm. You got spirit energy or life force energy radiating out of the heavens, right?
Right.
So a mound was a technology that would allow one to tap all three of those realms simultaneously.
Pyramids in Egypt and in other places around the world serve the same purpose?
For the most part, absolutely. Because more often than not, the mounds were ancestral burial grounds.
Okay.
So, right, for example, Thomas Jefferson, who was one of the first open mound gritters, we're going to talk about that, but these colonialists who actively sought out the mounds to build on top of, to tap this power, right? Thomas Jefferson excavated a mound and on his property at Monticello, and you know, guesstimated that, yeah, there was about 260 plus years of ancestral remains in this one mound. Okay, so there would be ancestral ancestral burial grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Then they would often be on top of the ley lines of planet Earth, which would basically be called the meridians. You know how the human body has meridians? That's mm-hmm. when you go to a acupuncturist and they hit you with needles at certain points. What they're doing is freeing up blockages in the meridian energy streams of the human body.
Uh-huh.
Well, the earth has meridians as well. And the mounds would be placed on these ley lines, magnetic field nodes, energy flux, energy attunement points of the earth. And the mounds would often be aligned with astrological and galactic bodies within the heavens, so that at certain times of the year, celestial events would happen aligned with the mounds. You know? So, yeah, again, it was a spiritual technology that allowed the mound builders to tap the ancestral, terrestrial, and celestial life force energy at one time.
Okay.
And you know, it's fascinating because if you think about the implications of the idea of 12,000 year civilization developing this spiritual technology, and then these European colonists coming over, obviously having foreknowledge of this themselves. Because, as you've pointed out, many Germanic Rosicrucians came and settled right around this crisscrossing of the waterways, which turns out to be one of the most potent ley line conjunctions, correct? In the Philadelphia waterway region?
Yes.
Right where they read the Declaration of Independence, for example, and right where they started the government of the United States?
Absolutely.
How significant?
Absolutely.
How significant is that? And you think about the Freemasons that were involved in this, who the Freemasons' rituals and pseudo-history that they use to trace back their traditions are rooted in the Atlantean vision, if not, it's very vague, but it's there. And that the presence of the ancient civilizations and the idea of tapping into geomancy and geometry and geology, because we're talking about stonemasons, so we're talking about earth and geology. And then another factor that might be considered is that the ancient order of druids, which rose up in the wake of the Industrial Revolution, which really had its birth, if nowhere else, in America and England, right? And these places... The Druid rituals was an attempt to re-empower the individual by aligning them to earth energies in the same fashion that you broke down for us with this three-realm idea. And I really think this is important for people to think about. Because like you said, there's an ancestral realm which connects us to our genetic memory, the Akashic record, if you will. And then there's the terrestrial realm, which connects us to the geometry and the geology of the earth. And then there's the celestial realm, which connects us to cosmic consciousness and our own inner consciousness, our own divine spark. And in the same way, the Druid path has the three rays of light, which represent the telluric or earth energy, the solar or energy of the sun, and then the lunar energy of the moon. And each one of those has the same corresponding meanings.
Wow.
So, wow, right? So now we're on to something. You mentioned the mound builders. You claim in your research you've found, you've claimed that you believe that the Lenapes were the mound builders?
Yeah, they were. At the time of William Penn and the colonial appearance on the Americas, the Lenape were the custodians of the sacred mounds at that time.
So perhaps they didn't necessarily build them, because there have been a lot of, you know, queries, I suppose, about who actually built them, and they are attributed a lot to a lot of the Native American tribes around. And I know that for the Cherokee, they were aware of them too, but they also claim to have just been kind of taking care of them, that they didn't build them, and that they were built long, long before them, which could be the Lenape, because if you're saying they're 12,000 years ago, that certainly predates the Cherokee.
Yes. That's a big ongoing debate, mm-hmm. and that debate was actually, well, you could say, started back colonial times, and it was the big argument between Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, where Thomas Jefferson felt that the Algonquin of their day were the mound builders in actuality, mm-hmm. where Ben Franklin felt that the mound builders were a Atlantean race that had long since kind of disappeared, and that the current indigenous that they saw in this land were merely custodians who inherited the mounds, you know? So it's hard to say. And I might even throw in another layer of complexity and say it could be both and, you know? In some way, it mm-hmm. can be both and. That the Lenape were current custodians, but were connected genetically to the original mound builders. You know, so right. It's like I said, there's some mystery around that. It's still clarity to be penetrated on that, for sure.
Definitely.
You know, I just wanted to interject a couple of points here. You made some comments when you were talking about this. You said, for example, that if we're looking at a 12,000-year linear progression, we're talking about pre-flood antediluvian time period. And, you know, that immediately for me sparks the research I'm involved in right now, which is looking at the extra-biblical materials found in the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Library, dealing with the books like the Book of Enoch, the Book of Jasher, the Book of Jubilees, the Book of Noah. And those, of course, some of those are just fragments, but the Book of Enoch is pretty complete at this point. And, you know,
yes.
We hear talk of the fallen ones, the angels who came down and basically bred with humanity, and according to Genesis chapter 6, gave us giants, monsters, and heroes of renown, which they called the Nephilim. And I just wonder what your thoughts are with regards to the theories that are coming out right now. It seems like a postmodern push talking about giants and the giant species that pre-existed even the native tribal peoples. And if you look at like the Paiute legend, don't they even mention a war between them and the giants?
Not just the Paiute, but near Catalina Island too. They would they eventually killed off the giants by trapping them in caves and burning them alive. But these giants would be even eating the Native American peoples, which is why they would eventually become, come to a point where they were fighting them.
What are your thoughts on this, Ross?
Yeah, well, there is a tradition that the Lenape slayed a race of giants.
Wow.
And, vanquished them. And to kind of even build on that more, it seems like there are two general types of mound structures found in the Americas. One is the, conical sepulchral mound, where it's, kind of a rounded pyramidal shaped structure that has the ancestral remains in it. Then you have these enclosure of kind of, for lack of a better word, fortress mounds, which are these other structures. The use could be astronomical, astrological, but there also seems to be a defensive military intention built into them as well. And I have seen information to suggest that maybe there were two different, we say, races of mound builders.
Okay.
One's being more militaristic and on a, kind of on a war nature, and the possibility that maybe those were the giants. And you're right, throughout the Americas, they have found these remains of giant beings, 7, 8, 12 feet tall, some with really other, amazing genetics, like two rows of teeth,
Yeah,
and
I will even
toes.
Say, too, that one of the neighboring clans of the Lenape, the Susquehannock, who lived in the Susquehanna Valley, which is kind of around where Harrisburg, Pennsylvania is, They were legend to be giants. They were legend to be, averaging 8 or 9 feet tall,
Do the legends mention anything cannibalism?
Yeah, I have seen that they were, right, giants that ate, all manner of beasts,
right.
Fowl, animals, and humans, But I was going to say that the modern day land grab of the mounds really, I think, is an extension of a battle coming out of antiquity, The battle of the mounds and battle of the control of the mounds. It didn't just start in colonial time,
Oh, no, of course not.
I even think Viking legend and tradition has some keys to this puzzle as well.
Oh, I'm sure it does. Do you think there's any relationship between, say, the mounds and, especially, Serpent Mound, for instance, and the Nazca Lines in Peru?
I'm not sure.
It's just I know that was totally random. I'm sorry.
Actively researched that connection.
Well, you know, I wanted
to... No worries.
No, yeah, it's great. This is a great conversation. I wanted to also say that, you know, it really strikes me when we talk about these legends around the Americas, and then you combine it, for folks that out there are listening right now, do a little research, some search engine, you know, keyword searches, and you'll find that there are a plethora of accounts of giant remains being discovered all over America through the late 18th and all through the 19th and into the early 20th century. And there are various accounts of masses of people who witnessed these things. They had, Mater X mentioned Catalina Island. There was a museum there that was the Wrigley family, I believe, had ran a museum, the owners of the Wrigley Spearmint Gum Company, I believe. And they ran a museum up into the 30s where they had thousands of giant remains on display, and people could buy giant bones from the gift counter, and there was something like 500 authentic photographs of all the remains, which were all eventually shut down and taken and spirited away by the Smithsonian Institute, like something out of Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, pushing into that room where all the boxes are, you know, and just, whoops, it's gone, you know, whoopsie, we lost right. it, you know, and so, right? But meanwhile, I find this correlation between these ancient accounts here in America and then the Book of Enoch and these other books from the Levant, from the Palestinian region, from the places where the ancient peoples of America, of humanity first started to talk about, like Mount Hermon region, the Jordan, River Jordan region, where the Qumran Monastery was, where the books from the Dead Sea Scrolls were accumulated, and even the northern upper Egypt region of Nag Hammadi, which also books and libraries were gathered, which account for these watcher, fallen angel-like beings coming down, interacting with humanity, producing offspring, which eventually have such an appetite that they devour all flesh and themselves, not just other humans. They started to eat each other, and just in constant hunger, which in the Book of Enoch led to God deciding to wipe everything out with the flood. You know, you mentioned right at the beginning how these cultures all existed pre-flood time. And I just find it remarkable, the synchronicity, you know, the lining up of the dots here of information and research, which lead us towards these conclusions almost naturally. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, while we're on the subjects of the giants of the giant's remains, I just wanted to say that we did find an interesting account of a speech. We were going to read the speech, but we don't need to this time. But it's a speech done by Abraham Lincoln, I believe it was 1844. And I don't know if he actually gave the speech, because there's sort of conflicting evidence to say that he just wrote the speech and he may not have delivered it. But he was en route to the Niagara Fall regions, and he was given a speech. It was real expansive, talking about the expansive view, the nation-state view of America, you know, like just how all the founding fathers like to invoke that kind of expansive view. And he referred to the mound-building giants, the species. Mm. Do you recall that, the detail exactly on that?
No, not. I mean, it had to do with just how old the Niagara region actually was, and how old the falls were, and how there were. He basically mentioned that there were giants in that region, and that.
Wow.
And he said it like from the evidence that's overwhelming all over America of the giants' remains, you know, and how their eyes peered at these falls as well. It was just phenomenal. And it's something anybody can, again, keyword search Abraham Lincoln's speech referring to giants, and you'll find it's just the most fascinating little, you know, reference that just, what it tells me is in the 1844 time period of America, it was a given. It was a given to the average citizen that there was a huge prehistory to this country, and that there was different species of humanity and giants and other things, you know, that we have not been privy to. And it always comes back to the suppression of reality, the suppression of the truth is a way of, it's a tool of control. And that's really what, when you talk about the free your mounds, that battle cry, that, you know, call to action, free your mounds, what it says to me, Ross Ben, is that I get this idea that you're talking about, you know, empowering ourselves by liberating the planet, liberating the world from the stranglehold, of oppression that's placed over it through counterfeit reality, through falsehood, and through misrepresentation and ignorance, to ignore the truth. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. Well, how I framed it at the Free Your Mind conference, the subtler informs the denser, right? So now there's four general densities to our reality. We got the physical, the emotional, the mental, and the spiritual. So if I want to control your body, right, the best way to do it is to control your emotions.
Yeah.
Manipulate your pleasure principle. Put a reward or consequence, you know, reality around you. If I can manipulate your emotions, it's going to be easy to control your body.
Right.
If I want to control your emotions, the best way to do it is to manipulate your mind. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Play mind games on you. Trick you out with your values to get you to be easily emotionally manipulated.
Right.
So following that, if I want to control your mind, I have to manipulate your spirit. The subtle informs the denser.
Mm.
Right?
Right, right.
So by occupying the mounds, and there's these historic figures who I call the mound gritters, and that was their whole thing, occupying the mounds. By occupying the mounds, it cut people's spirits off from those three realms we talked about, thus making their minds easy to control and manipulate. And that science generally can be called geomancy. You know, specifically we would call it urban geomancy, you know. And these mound gritters is the one carrying out that science. And I guess you could say they are a Masonic order, but, you know, there's so many orders and varieties of Masons. It's hard to say that. I don't think you can say flip them practice it. It's, you know, one particular order.
Well, that's a great point. You make a very great point there, Ross. And when I made that kind of offhand statement about them being Freemasons, it was a generalized term. But can you tell us, you mentioned Monticello. Now, that means little mound, right?
Yes, Monticello, yes. I was going to mention that because the first six presidents of the U.S., we can definitely say they were mound gritters. Meaning they would look for a mound, right?
Right.
And build their scene on top of it to tap that energy, okay? And each of their residences bear witness to that reality. So George Washington, his residence is Mount Vernon, Virginia.
Wow.
John Adams, his residence was Richmond, New York.
Huh.
Thomas Jefferson, Monticello, the Little Mound in Virginia. James Madison, Montpelier, Virginia, the Mount of the Pilgrim.
Huh.
James Monroe, Monroe Hill, Virginia, where contemporary UVA is. And John Quincy Adams lived at Meridian Hill in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
So, these cats were mound gritters. The Adams family being, you know, the Adams family, they were.
Sorry, I can't help but laugh.
Right. But they were some serious mound gritters.
Right.
Going back to their, their great-grandfather, Henry Adams, who settled at Mount Wollaston in Boston. And yeah. But Ben Franklin was also a mound gritter, even though he wasn't a president. And his mound edifice is his mound edifice is the Philadelphia Museum of Art, which Ben Franklin Parkway, you know, feeds right into. And the Philadelphia Museum of Art is built on top of the most sacred mound of the Lenape.
Okay? Wow, that's really interesting.
This mound was so sacred, the Lenape said, whatever happens at this mound and in the land around it happens with the full participation of the earth.
So that's really interesting, right? You mentioned that, okay? And our history books would teach us that Ben Franklin discovered electricity. So do you think that his, I don't want to say agenda, but that's the best word that comes to my mind, was different than, say, Jefferson's and Washington's? And do you think that, I mean, you mentioned that his mound is where the Museum of Art is, as opposed to just these homes and, you know, power places of these other men, of the other presidents.
Well, Mike, there's a couple of connections there. One is Franklin was a member of a fraternal order that was called the Order of the Nine Muses. And that's the whole science of a museum, you know?
Okay.
And this Order of the Nine Muses, this was the order that Franklin was able to be an emissary both for the United States, France, and England, Great Britain. And it was his role, you know, we know that the French helped the quote-unquote help fund the American Revolution,
right,
but they helped in a much more significant way too, and that was the dividing and the conquering of the indigenous in this realm. So you had the Treaty of 1754 at the Albany Congress, where the Lenape were really manipulated off of this land by Ben Franklin, because the Lenape were attempting to kick the British out of the Lenapehana Valley, out of the Delaware Valley.
Okay.
And they had petitioned the Iroquois, the Algonquin speakers of the Ohio Valley.
Okay.
Right? Meanwhile, the Iroquois were engaged in a fight against the French who were coming down out of Canada and incurring on their lands.
Okay.
Ben Franklin was able to broker a deal with the Iroquois to say, hey, if you don't ally with the Lenape, I'll get the British colonists to help you in your fight against the French. And the Iroquois agreed. That was the Treaty of 1754 at the Albany Congress. So once that happened, the Lenape were expelled from Penn's Woods, from Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
And his reward for that effort was being given nomenclature, or giving name of the most sacred spot in Lenape Hoking, which was the mound of that the Philadelphia Art Museum is built on. And that's Fairmount. When you hear about Fairmount Park in Philadelphia, that's a play on Fire Mount. Which is what the Swedes, because there was a Swedish colony here from the 1500s in the Lenape Hanna Valley. And the The Swedes called it Fire Mound because they would have their solstice bonfires at this mound. When the French merchants heard of this sacred place, they started calling it Mount de Feu, or the Mound of Fire, because the Swedes would have their bonfires there. And then that just became Fire Mount or Fair Mount. And again, it's all reference to the sacred mound that the Art Museum is built on. So when you see Rocky running up those stairs, he's running up.
Wow.
And that's the spot, Ross Ben, you said that's the spot where the earth will support whatever endeavor is commenced.
Whatever happens, the Lenape say, whatever we do here happens with the full participation of the earth. That's why Philadelphia is what you would call a foundry. It's a place, it's the jump off. So when those founding fathers came together and signed the Declaration of Independence, they did it with the full participation of the earth. That's why the United States, with all of its, you know, all the wild things it does around the world, and we know that. We know some of the wild things it does, right? It does end up with seeming with providence and grace.
And you wonder, how in the world could this actually be happening? It's magic.
It's magic.
It's happening with the magic of the earth being utilized, right, by people who may not have everyone else's best intentions at heart. And it seems to me like history is repeating itself again, in the sense that we're pitting one group of people, you know, our government is interfering in the various things going on around the world and supporting one side or another or both against each other, just so that they can get in there somehow and maybe utilize the earth magic of that particular region.
Exactly.
And you know,
that's the real significance of Philadelphia.
Wow.
Philadelphia is a deep place. It's got some real powers to it.
Can you talk a little bit more about the Algonquins and the Lenape from the Philadelphia region? Their vision, their approach to life, and you know what they foresaw for humanity. Do you have can you kind of like give the listeners a little bit of a picture?
I'll do my best. Well, the Lenape, the Lenni Lenape, their name means the elders of humanity, the men of men. And they considered themselves the elders of humanity, okay? And they were actually the grandfather clan of all of the Algonquin speakers in the north, along the northeast and mid-Atlantic coastline. So where basically you could say the extent of the original 13 colonies, all of the Algonquin speakers of that region, they held the Lenape as their elder clan or their grandfather clan. So the Powhatans, the Wampanoag, you know, mm-hmm. all of them looked at the Lenape as being as their elders, you know.
Okay.
And this region, Philadelphia, was called Shaksamoxen, which meant place where the kings meet. So this was Philadelphia, modern Philadelphia, was the indigenous capital for the Algonquin speakers along the northeast coast. And it was here they would come and settle land, usage rights, and you know, hunting agreements, and you know, whatever was needed for harmonious coexistence.
So basically, it was the capital of the Indian nations or of that region. So we just kind of the colonialists just kind of came in and took over the capital and made it their own for a little while until it changed to DC. And took control of all of that power. That's crazy. It's interesting, you know, I've recently been researching the Cherokee Indians, and it from what I've read recent just last couple days about the Lenni Lenape, their societal structure was a lot similar to the Cherokee in the sense that, like, they inhabited a particular region, but had separate but interrelated, I guess you could say, communities or settlements. And each one had their own dialect, but they were all still part of the whole. And I find that interesting that that it kind of is like one group of Indians. And that's the best word I can come up with. You know, even Indians prefer to be called Indians sometimes.
Rather than I know Native what you're American. Saying. Yes,
But then, you know, to see that there have been just like regions of tribes, you know, from like the southeast, northeast is what we're talking about today. Also in the southwest, there was the Anasazi that predated the Hopi and the Pueblo, and in the southwest region that were around the same time period as the Lenni Lenape, actually. I think that they had a pretty similar setup in that way. It's very interesting, the whole history of this part of the world, because it is completely outside of the Western story, you know, that originated in the Middle East and came and spread throughout that area, because this was like an invisible part of the world. And you mentioned earlier Atlantis, and I'm almost obsessed with Atlantis, and I'm always thinking about it and wondering where it was and when it was actually around and how far back or actually close to our time period it actually was. So it's interesting to hear that somebody else mentioned a correlation between the tribal people of this continent and Atlantis.
Ross, you've painted this picture for us of a people that had a rich culture that obviously spanned millennia, and that they had a fully established civilization here in these regions. And the real tragedy of all this is that what we do know about what took place with the colonialization, you know, with the colonies being formed, what took place was this tragic attempt by a people who had, you know, a noble dignity and an honorable tradition, and trying to first resist, then somehow maintain, then eventually trying to preserve their own endangered, you know, existence. And you know, people love to flippantly dismiss with ignorance the idea that, well, you know, we wiped them out. That was progress. That's evolution. You know, that's how it goes. And you know, that's not really how things went. And I think that the most amazingly untalked about chronicle of colonial history is the King Philip's War. Right? I mean, you agree with this, I know. And the fact
that's that's also called the Seven-Year War, the French and Indian War, is that all the same?
Well, it's not all the same, actually, because the okay. King Philip's War actually occurred in 1675, and it was a two-year conflict where more than half of the New England towns were assaulted by the natives. And from that time, you know, there was a time period in 1676, 100 years before the Revolution, where it appeared that the entire English population of Massachusetts and Rhode Island might be driven back into a handful of fortified seacoast cities because of the onslaught of the Algonquins, the Narragansetts, and a few other tribes that were making serious progress in putting down the colonists. And the only reason why they were able to, or the only reason why the colonists succeeded eventually was through treaties with rival tribes, by getting to turn against each other. That's the only way. And the Narragansetts, they lost a decisive battle. Their king, the chief that was leading the battle was captured, and he was tortured and executed by the colonists. And also, the King Philip himself, who was known as Metacom, he was unable to enlist the aid of the Mohicans and the Algonquins to help him fight the English settlers. And so he went in search of help from the Mohicans and the Algonquins, but they turned him back. I'm not sure, maybe you know the reason why they didn't want to get in behind the you know, the Algonquins and the, or I'm sorry, the Narragansetts and the Samosets, who were the ones that were fighting the English settlers. But, you know, there's a lot of, people don't realize, in the population of New England, nearly 52,000 colonists died during this two-year battle at twice the rate of the Civil War and more than seven times the rate of World War II. I mean, this is a huge, huge numbers that the whole thing's basically suppressed. You never see a movie of the week about the King Philip's War. You never see a, you know, a big Hollywood production with Mel Gibson or whoever at the lead, you know, of a, because in fact, it's a shameful chapter of the history, because the English colonists in many cases would just abandon their families and run for it and leave them, you know, behind to be taken captive or murdered or, you know, otherwise destroy their whole settlements out of total cowardice, you know, and it, you know, just showed the real, what the reason why I bring it up is to point out that it was a real battle and a real struggle of conquest. It wasn't this easy transition between the colonists showing up, them making settlements, and it being America. It was a conquest that occurred, right?
Right. And then on the flip side of that, the significance of Penn Treaty. Because Penn Treaty occurred at Shaxamaxon. So when William Penn was granted this land by Chief Tammany, what happened? It happened with the full participation of the earth.
That is another really good point to make, actually, because when you throw that in, that dimension into it, you see that that explains a lot as to how the colonists and how the original, you know, so-called founding fathers would have been able to get such a foothold on what seemed like such a fully established civilization for so long before these greedy men showed up. For so long, you know, they seemed to be thriving. How could they let slip this you know, elegant culture and approach to reality? But in fact, it's through, like you said, it's through dark occulted magic, you know, negative intentions.
And if I could even build on that, because, and this is my understanding of something, this will even build on, you asked me to paint a picture of the Lenape, but it also ties right in with this. And I even want to even back up a little bit to say, it's my understanding that the idea, this theme that we have in quote-unquote America of give me your tired, your poor, your struggling masses yearning to be free, right? That was a value that the Algonquin of the Northeast, I mean of the Atlantic seaboard, that they held. Meaning, if you came, because we know that there was the Moorish Moroccan Empire that was a transatlantic empire that was connected with the Olmec peoples, that they were having a lot of problems with Rome. And the biggest thing the Moorish Empire was trying to prevent from Rome was a couple of things. One, they didn't want them getting out of the Straits of Gibraltar. And two, they didn't want them finding the British Isles and the tin mines that were up there, because that gave their alloys, their metallic alloys, a stronger, you know, a greater strength. So why didn't they want to let them out of Gibraltar? Because they were hiding their refuge, which was the Americas. So the Algonquin speakers of the Atlantic coastline, they had a value amongst their society that said, hey, if you made it across the Americas, escaping persecution, escaping war, you follow some basic laws, you can have as much land as you walk in a day. Okay? That's how a lot of the colonists were able to come over here. And that was why, if you study colonial history, there was always this theme of the colonists coming to escape persecution, right? Ideal, that value was already here, okay? So William Penn being granted some land wasn't too strange. A lot of the colonists up in the New England area being granted some land by the natives, not out of the picture, but you did have to kind of live. There was five basic laws you had to kind of honor, which, you know, is basically, you know, honor your next man, don't pollute the land, you know, come and live in harmony, right? But some land, I'm sure, was sacred and not up for offer. And I think Shaksamoxen was one of those lands. Now, was it the chiefs who had the power and the authority to grant land to someone seeking it? You know, like say a chief would say, hey, Frater X, you my man. You just came over here. You're escaping persecution. You can have as much land as you can walk in a day. No, it wasn't their decision. It was the grandmother clan. The grandmothers, the elder mommies, were the ones who could say, yeah, you can rest here, or yes, you could have this land, right? So I think William Penn was petitioning Shaksamoxen specifically, not just some land in the Lenapehana Valley, but the actual land where the Fairmount Mound was, where the sixth ley line convergence point is, which is, you know, kind of where Independence Hall is, Six and Market. And the Queen Mothers were like, no, you can't have that land. You can have some land, but you can't have that land. And I think what was orchestrated and what is memorialized in the George Washington equestrian statue, which sits in front of the Franklin Museum, was the assassination of Chief Tammany's wife, the Queen Mother at the time, who was known historically as Winona, or Queen Winona. And it was the assassination of Queen Winona and the minimalization of the women decision-making powers in Lenape society that opened the door for Chief Tammany to be able to sit down with William Penn and actually have Penn Treaty go down the way it went. So that's another, what you say, esoteric, crypto, historical piece that I've been able to put together in researching Mystic Philadelphia. And again, this event is memorialized in the George Washington equestrian statue that's at Eakins Oval at Ben Franklin Parkway, where you see an indigenous woman dressed as a Greek goddess, which shows that not only was she queen, they also say Queen Winona was a goddess. Okay? Chief Tammany, his name, Chief Tammany's name means easy to talk to. And when you look into the historical records to find out why was Tammany easy to talk to, they say he was easy to talk to because he had intercourse with a divine being. So who was he having intercourse with but his wife, Queen Winona? So she was a goddess. And in this statue at Eakins Oval, she's obviously an indigenous woman because there's Native American servants circled around her as well as Native American wildlife encircling her. But she's positioned as a like a Greek goddess, right? She's got a wreath, a laurel wreath. She's holding a trident, which says that, right, she was part of this transatlantic empire.
Right, I was about to say something about that. Yeah.
Yes.
That's amazing.
And on either side of her are colonialists. With one hand, one is extending a wreath in one hand with a cloaked dagger in the other. The other is tipping his hat in honor, and he has a cloaked dagger, and they're coming to assassinate her. Okay?
Coming in like friends and then taking her life and stealing the power.
And on top of all of this drama is George Washington on a horse.
Wow.
Where you see Ben Franklin positioned in this, you have, there's like a line of colonialists. And they're all looking in the direction of Queen Winona about to be assassinated, except Ben Franklin, who's looking the other way.
Huh.
Yeah, so it's... This statue
is that see no evil? Is that what he's doing?
Yes.
Trying to wash his hands of it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Gosh. So now, this statue is one of the most important statues in American history to decipher.
Huh.
And it really is part of a series of statues along Kelly Drive that really tell this story more in depth. You know. And
Next time we're in Philly, you'll have to show us.
It'd be my honor.
All of it.
Yes.
That's incredible, man. I mean, it speaks volumes to me because I often think of our Earth history as being so much different than where any of us are really led to believe, you know. And there have been archaeological finds in the Middle East and other regions around the world that presupposed a goddess-worshipping culture that was relatively peaceful with little here and there things going on, but for the most part, really connected to the earth, really connected to the sacred feminine. And the fact that you're saying to me that this queen of the Lenape was dressed in what looked to be Greek garb and holding a trident really... It actually validates my own personal theory, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who's come up with this, but of the Earth really having been a far more connected global culture than we even realize, probably not as long ago, as we like to think it is.
Absolutely, absolutely. Americas were not discovered.
Mm-mm. No way. No way.
And they were. Yeah, it was part of a transatlantic empire that was dismantled.
Right.
And its history erased.
Absolutely. And there's actually new theories about the Native Americans, the indigenous peoples of this continent and South America, having actually not migrated south from the north, but rather north from the south. The Cherokee in particular had a very unique basket weaving method that kind of was standalone from many of the other tribes of the North American continent, but was very prevalent in South America. And I always posit the idea that, like, maybe Antarctica is more connected to Atlantis than we actually realize, and that perhaps whatever happened back then pre-flood caused them to disperse from there and then go forth and then populate other areas, unbeknownst to the other side of the world, maybe.
Yes.
And that whole Olmec connection that you make too, that could actually be that could fill in the gap there.
It absolutely could, especially with the Moorish connection too. You know, the Phoenicians were a
global maritime civilization,
right. And the Moors are, you know, Spanish African looking people, and even maybe there might be a relation between the Moors, the Olmecs, and the Aboriginal cultures of Australia, who look rather African and consider themselves also to be the original people, just like the Lenape do, and I'm sure other ancient cultures around the world do.
It's really a fascinating premise. The idea you're talking about, the dismantling of a global a global civilization. I mean, this is a whole revised view of ancient history and pre-Diluvian history, which is, like you said, I mean, this would explain it all. If this was what the program was, it would be so important to suppress the data, to suppress the histories, and that would explain the program of all the Franciscans and the Jesuits of destroying all the sacred writings and all the ritualistic tools of the cultures that they came across in the so-called New World.
Makes me also wonder about, like, say, the Aztec, right? How we're taught to believe that they were this blood-worshipping, sacrificing culture, which they may have been, but you know, their temples, their ziggurats, those are temples as well. They were, you know, for spiritual purposes as well. So I sometimes just wonder how much of what we're told really, you know, really happened, or if it's just the case of the victors, right, the history books.
Yes. Yes. What they say, until the lion tells the story, the hunter will always win.
Well, that's excellent. Till the lion tells the story, hunters will always win. That's so true. You know, I mean, this has been a fascinating conversation with you, Ross Ben. I really wanna extend our appreciation for you taking the time to basically unpack a whole new view of history as we understand it, and some really exciting ideas and visions of the electrical universe that we inhabit, you know, and the energy grids that crisscross our world and are available to our consciousness and available to our awareness. And, you know, before you go, I wanted to ask you about some of your material. You know, I know that we've mentioned your website, which is rossben.com, and you mentioned your YouTube channel. Did you want to mention that again?
Yes, yeah, rossben188. And yeah, I will say I do have some events coming up. I will plug, because they're in New York. So if you got a market in New York, you know, they can catch me live and direct. April 6th, I'm going to be at Nicholas Brooklyn, which is at 570 Fulton Street, downtown Brooklyn. Going to be sharing, it's going to be a workshop on crystal and sound therapy. So we're going to learn and experience how to heal using crystals and sound. And that's being co-facilitated with myself and Kafunya Ife. And then April 27th, I want to be in Harlem, New York, at a, I think it's a historical event. It's the New Covenant First Annual UFO Conference for Melanated People. So this is a UFO conference,
cool.
You know, in the hood, basically, you
right.
know. And it's going to be myself, Dr. Phil Valentine, Dr. Delbert Blair, and Brother Polite. And so this is definitely a pinnacle of my, you know, humble self in terms of presenting. This is definitely on caliber with the Free Your Mind Conference as far as coming together of powerful minds. And, you know, I'm humbled to be a part of that. So, I, you know, I got those things jumping off. Also, something else. I've been dealing with lately, Star Nations, you know, what they call the, you know, UFO ET reality. And I've just completed a DVD called The Heavens Are Open, which you mentioned Enoch, the Book of Enoch. The Book of Enoch is so powerful, man, that, man, we could do a, let's plan in the future when you guys, got another opening in your rotation. Let's just do a show on the Book of Enoch.
Sounds good.
Yes.
I use that awesome. As a foundation. I use that as a foundation to show who these Star Nations really are, you know? Because they really are the angels of the Most High coming to reconcile a lot of the wrongs that we've been did, a lot of the corruption and ill things that we were talking about today. Yeah, the Star Nations have returned. The heavens are open to right these wrongs. So that's what my latest DVD is on. And It's hot off the press, and I'm going to start promoting it actively on the web very shortly.
And that's called The Heavens Are Open?
The Heavens Are Open, which is really a key to New Testament prophecy, you know? The Heavens Are Open is a saying that's found in the New Testament 5 times. Mm. And once you realize they're talking about the heavens opening, meaning the star nation's returning, then you really get a clearer understanding of what New Testament prophecy, when they talk about the New Jerusalem coming out, you know, this city of God coming out of the heavens and creating a new heaven and a new earth, right?
Hmm.
Yeah, it's...
using the terminology of the time.
Exactly. So that's been my latest works, you know?
And we can all find out more information by going to rossben.com, right?
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
You're on Facebook as well for anybody that's
as Ross Ben.
Right. And, you know, I'm really excited about this new research you're talking about. I think it's important that we get as many perspectives on board as we can to look at things, because it's through the divided diversity and the different perspectives that we gain greater understanding and clarity of all things, you know. And the evidence is clear that there's more to life and there's more going on in reality than we have been led to believe. And you know, you mentioned this new book, and you're talking about your new approach it's your personal approach to some really powerful experiences that you've had, right?
You're talking about Mystic Philadelphia?
No.
You're talking about the Star Nations.
Yeah, the Star Nations. Absolutely. And the Heavens Are Open. This is a... Let's shift gears a little. We'll talk about this a little before we let you go. And talk about, you know, the powerful experiences that you've had that have given you insight to share what you have to say to folks.
Yeah, well, I have been honored to, have a couple of live and direct experiences, you know. The most recent being last August, right out in West Philadelphia, at a reggae concert, vending at a reggae concert, and looking up in the sky, talking with a friend, and then bam, these orbs just appeared in my field of vision. And I was like, yo, do you see those orbs? Talking to the brother I was with, and he didn't see them at first. They were high in the sky. Best way to describe them at this point was like stars out in the middle of the day, you know, like points of light very high up, but they were moving around, and one of them was red, you know, so it was obvious they were Star Nation. And first he didn't see them, then my wife, a couple of other sisters came up, and I pointed it out to them, and they saw them. And what was it? But then it got deeper, because one of them descended. One of them came down below the clouds and no longer appeared like an orb of light, but like almost like a stick figure. And then all of these chemtrail-bearing airplanes started flying towards him. And he flew off, and then the sky was blanketed with chemtrails.
Wow.
Are you familiar with sylphs? The idea of a...
Yes,
sylph?
I am.
You think that's what you saw, maybe?
Nah, this was... I'm familiar with a sylph, which is a air elemental.
Right, right.
That appears as an angelic cloud.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
No, this would be I guess, in the Book of Enoch would be referred to the Ophanim. The third order
of angels.
Below the seraphim and the cherubim. The seraphim and the cherubim, they never leave the seventh heaven. But then you have the Ophan, who can traverse the seven heavens. And
which were the Ophanites, or the serpent handlers, right? It was connected to serpent,
yes.
Serpent typography.
Yes. And so that connects them with Quetzalcoatl.
The plume serpent.
And the plume serpent.
It's funny, I just read something about18 that was found, a giant body that was found with a feathered headdress, like Made me think of Quetzalcoatl.
And then Viracocha, too, right? Viracocha is another one. Isn't he plumed serpent or feathered serpent-like? I thought he was. Viracocha.
Yeah, I'm not familiar.
Kukulkan? Kukulkan?
Yeah, Kukulkan. Yeah, all of these are visions of the Quetzalcoatl, yes.
Right, just a different interpretations.
Also, that Imhotep priesthood coming out of the Nile Valley, whose emblem was the Cadasis, you know, the winged serpent.
Right.
So,
which is connected to Herte or Thoth, who was also associated with Enoch. Wow, we came back around full circle right there.
Exactly. There you go. You got it. You're right on it, brother. And it's all, that's what I delve into.
Go ahead.
That's what I delve into on The Heavens Are Open. Penetrate all of those mysteries right there.
Well, you know, I wanted to have you mention that because I really do want to plan another show with you, and we will talk about the Book of Enoch because that's also the main focus of my new work, you know, the research I'm doing with the fallen angels and the dark occulted mystics in America and the connection to the legends and folklore of the giants and monsters and all of it, the suppressed histories of America. But, you know, I too have had sightings. I've had experiences. The first one I had, I was a very young boy. I was probably younger than my youngest son. I was probably 5 or 6 years old. And I was with my adult stepfather, who we both witnessed it, broad daylight, a metallic object that was shaped like an old-fashioned top above a body of water near the Marconi wireless radio tower array, which was connected to the 10 wireless stations across the eastern seaboard. And that's right where we saw this vehicle. And it moved with speeds beyond anything I've ever seen in my life. It basically seemed to dematerialize. It went so fast in the opposite direction of our sight. It seemed to shrink down to a tiny ball and disappear. It moved so fast. And I was, like I said, I was a small child. I remember looking up at my father and saying to him, "What is that? Do you see that?" You know, and he said, "Yeah, I see it. I don't know what it is." And we stood there for what seemed like forever, you know, looking at it, and then it took off, and that was the first thing. That was pre-Star Wars. That was pre, you know, Battlestar Galactica and all that stuff, right? And then a few other times in my life, I've had other experiences right up until the present day myself. So I would love to have you come back on. We could do a whole show devoted to this material as well, because we obviously can really, together, all three of us have unpacked some amazing research and knowledge today that I think the listeners out there are really gonna enjoy what we've come up with. And you know, I'm thinking we probably want to wrap it up here because we've been going pretty good for about an hour and a half. If there was anything else you wanted to add before we came to a close.
No, I think that's it. Other than you know, wishing you all and everyone that's listening guidance, protection, prosperity for the remainder of this year. And I give thanks for this opportunity.
Oh, again, Ross Penn, we really appreciate you coming and helping us to relaunch the show. And again, everybody go to rossbenn.com and keep getting updated on all the exciting and amazing activities he's delving into and the research he's coming up with and the media that he's putting out there for people, providing for people to gain insight into the truth, to the true nature of ourselves and our surroundings, which is makes him another light bearer and way shower, a foster parent, and we really appreciate you as that. And also, we wanted to let everybody know that you can continue to follow all of our exploits here in the Middle Chamber at the Middle Chamber Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at TMC369. We also have many other places to follow us. I have a blog called freighterx.blogspot.com. MaterX has a blog that is
MaterX369.blogspot.com.
And we
bear with me, it's still in its infancy. It's a slow growing child.
And of course, please keep checking back with thesyncbook.com for all the latest media coming out there. And that's where our radio network is located, the Syncbook Radio Network, where you can also find us on iTunes, Apple. You can find us on Stitcher. We're just everywhere, guys. So keep guys and gals, so keep a close watch and stay tuned to all the great stuff. Next week, we're going to actually take our first week off from the podcast. Maybe we'll produce one, but we're headed to Austin, Texas. We really want to focus on the public appearance that we're going to have. So we'll be back again in 2 weeks with another great guest. Some of the guests that we're going to have in the future, we're going to have Ron Patton from Paranoia Magazine, the publisher of Paranoia Magazine. We're going to have Olav Phillips, the executive producer of Anomaly's TV channel. We've got so many other great guests lined up to come in and share their media, share their research with us. And so once again, everybody, I want to say farewell. Thank you for listening. Please come again. We hope you enjoyed yourselves. And Mater X, you take it away. You ride it out to the sunset.
Thanks, Frater X. Ross, Ben, I wanted to extend my personal appreciation for you being here. I've actually been looking forward to speaking with you about this, all of this material, and really look forward to going into the Book of Enoch and whatever else we could all find to talk about, because your research is very much along the lines of my interests, and so it was really good to actually get a chance to sit down with you and talk about this stuff. So I just wanted to extend my appreciation and also my gratitude towards your wife and family for allowing you the time to do this too. I see you've got seven children. I don't know how in the heck you do it. And I mean, I'm saying that as a mother of four, knowing how much it is just, actually I've got five children and my oldest is grown, but we have four still growing here at home. And it's almost more than I think we can bear sometimes. And so to add three more children to that mix, I applaud the two of you immensely. So anyways, thank you
so
much.
I'm going to tell you my secret. My favorite holiday is coming up next month.
Would that be
420?
420. That's I was about to say that because I couldn't imagine it was actually Easter, but it just happens to coincide with it this year, oddly enough. Yes, that's one of my two favorite holidays, that and Halloween, which 420 kind of goes along with Halloween too. And so we can actually, next time we talk, we can go into that realm as well, if you'd like, because I've got some things to say about that as well. So anyhow, it's been really great talking with you tonight, and it's really great to be back here on the air. And I hope everyone that was joining us this evening has been enjoying this just as much as I have been.
All right, and keep checking back with all of our
new
and exciting things. Thank you, Ross, Ben, and everybody. Don't forget the chat room, which is at middlechamberchat.chatango.com, and the website is middlechamberfx.wordpress.com. Thanks again, everyone, and stay tuned to the next episode of The Middle Chamber, and have a great weekend.
Yes, sir. Blessings.